chapter 10, where we have the origin of the nations according to families and according to tongues, that is, the ethnic and linguistic division of the world, which of course had to follow the Babel judgment that is recorded in chapter 11. Just by way of review, let's state what we had last week. We saw, first of all, that God's plan for the post-diluvian civilization, that is, Noah and his three sons, was diffusion, to replenish or fill up the earth. It seems, and probably all were involved in this, that in direct disobedience, they, rather than diffusing, they centralized somewhere in the Mesopotamia Valley. Most likely, Nimrod was one of the leaders of this, and so God was disturbed by it, and so he then enforced his diffusion, and the means of enforcement was the confusion of the tongues. He made it so that these families could not understand each other, and then they began to spread abroad like he originally intended them to do. We must remember that when they left the ark, every living person had knowledge of the true God, and they were all believers. And so we began sort of a new age, an age of nationalism, an age when God intended for the world to be separate in terms of nation states and ethnic groups. That age will not end until the second advent, and even then it will be carried on somewhat. There will be nation states, but they will all be under the merciful and righteous judgment of Jesus Christ. There'll be sort of a centralized world power, but there will still be nation states. Now Genesis 10 told us how it began, and the verse begins this way. Now these are the generations of the son of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, and under them were sons born after the flood, the sons of Japheth, and there are seven mentioned. Now, in trying to prepare this for the overhead, where we could get it up where we could see it, I thought we would make a genealogical chart. And so we'll be working on Genesis 10, the settlement of the nations. And I will be writing on the overhead this genealogical chart. And we start, first of all, with Japheth. Now, lest I forget, when I get down in the genealogical chart, let's simply say that Japheth is the father or the progenitor of what is known as the Indo-Europeans. That way I won't have to write the word nations. Now I'm going to have to write small. If you can't see it, I suggest you move up. The Indo-European nations include the Greeks. They include the Latins. They include the Celts or the Celts. They include the Germans. They include the Scandinavians. They include the Western Russians, but we'll just write the word Russians up here. They include the Scythians. They include the Finns. Okay? When we talk about the Indo-European nations, we are talking about all of these nations. Now, the reason they are called Indo-European is because that a large branch of them settled in northern India, actually east of the Caspian Sea, in the upper reaches of what would be India today, right? Below, I guess you would say, the Himalaya Mountains. And although Japheth, the majority of the Japhethites are settled west of there in southern Europe. They begin to spread around the Mediterranean Sea, around the Adriatic Sea, in the islands that we know of, and then slowly filter north and so on. The majority settled there. There was a large colony in India. Okay? Now, in the genealogy, there are seven sons of Japheth. Now, it will take probably the whole page to list those sons. So, we'll draw the genealogical line, and we'll fill in the names of those seven sons. And then we'll try, hopefully, to get some idea of the nation states. The first one that is mentioned is Gomer. Gomer. Okay? Now, Gomer, in ancient literature, the writings of Herodotus, sometimes these place names or figures that are mentioned in Genesis 10 will be mentioned by Josephus, who was a contemporary with the Apostle Paul, also a contemporary of Jesus. Homer wrote maybe 1000 B.C. Herodotus, who was considered the patron saint of all historians, who was a Greek who wrote in the 5th century B.C., Thucydides, sometimes the Roman historian, Sallust, some of these other, Strabo, some of these men, mention these place names or these people. And among the ancients, Gomer was known as the progenitor of the Cimmerians, C-I-M-M-E-R-I-O-N-S. You'll find it spelled several ways, the Cimmerians. Now, interestingly enough, in the text, in the Hebrew text, when you get to verse 3, three of Gomer's sons are named. In other words, under Japheth, seven of his sons are named, and then seven of his grandsons. Three of his grandsons to Gomer, four of his grandsons to Javan. Now that's interesting because it is out of Gomer and out of Javan that you get the majority of the states. So let me, under Gomer, list these three sons that are found in verse 3. The sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, if you want to look in your Bible. Ashkenaz, A-S-H-K-E-N-A-Z. Ashkenaz. The second is Riphath. And the third is Togarmah. Togarmah. Now, of these, the first two are perhaps the easiest to identify. Ashkenaz is the father of many German Teutonic tribes. German Teutons. Riphath is a progenitor of the Celts or the Celts. I'll put this in parentheses to distinguish tribal names from personal names, okay? Now, Togarmah is a little bit difficult to identify. Some Aryans possibly came from Togarmah. Aryans were Indo-European Japhethites. And we know that some German tribes came from Togarmah. And you remember when Hitler wanted to propagate the idea that that the Germans were a superior race, that he used the name Aryan, the Aryan culture. Now this is exciting because it is out of this Celtic group, and I don't want to draw it in there, but we could draw maybe three lines or four lines right out of the Celtic group. The Celts are the progenitors of the Irish, the Britons, the Scots, and the Galatians, what we know as the Galatians in our Bible. In other words, many of the Teuton tribes, and we could put all kind of little lines out from these Teutons, the Vandals, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, the Angles, the Saxons, the Franks, the Jutes, all of these people are first or second cousins. In other words, the Franks and the Germans are related. The Saxons that moved into England, and the Angles that moved into England. They're all cousins. They're sort of all first cousins. When you get back this far. Okay? So Gomer is a progenitor of the Cimmerians or the Cimmerians, out of which we have a large majority of what we call Europe today. Okay? Okay. The second son of Japheth, that's mentioned in the list, is the name Magog. Magog. Now, Magog is a term that means out of Gog, or related to Gog, the place of Gog. And the place of Gog in the Bible is always Russia. But it's possible, under Magog, that some of the Slavs are involved. That is, the Czechoslovakians, the Serbians, the Croatians. Central Europe is involved, and perhaps Western Russia. Okay? The third name that's mentioned of the Japhetic sons, the third son, is Madai. M-A-D-A-I. These unquestionably were the Medes. There's no question about Madai. The Medes, the Madai are named in Syrian documents, ancient Syrian documents, and also, I think, by not Thucydides, but by Herodotus. And these are people who settled south of the Caspian Sea. Now, some of them were a little bit to the east of that, and they would be Aryans. So it's possible, see, that these Aryans were like first cousins or second cousins or related this way, see. Okay? And the Aryans, again, were Japhetic peoples who settled in the northern part of India, and their language was written Sanskrit, which is the, I want to say, the most ancient. It's the most ancient of documents in terms of writing that we have today of any extent. The next name, or the fourth son of Japheth that is mentioned, is Javan. Javan. Now, Javan is both Greek, Greece, and particularly the Ionian Greeks. Among the Greeks, there were several tribes. There were Thracians, Illyrians, Ionians, Dorians, and so on. These were Ionian Greeks, and they settled in the Peloponnesus, in the islands, those little islands that you see around the southern coast of Greece. Now, it's possible also that the Latins came out of here. So the Latins we're going to put a question mark on. One of the peoples that plagues the ancient historian is the Etruscans, those who lived on the Italian peninsula before the Latins came. These Etruscans most likely were Hamitic. They most likely came from North Africa. And we're going to show you that when we get to Ham. But later on, they are replaced in the boot by the Latins, and it's very possible that they were descendants of Jabal. The next name is hard to identify, Tubal. Tubal. Now, Tubal is probably part of Russia, but possibly also Hungary, and we'll put a question mark after that. The Hungarians are from the Magyars, and the Magyars are a weird bunch. In terms of location, they were some of the most voracious of all the European ancient tribes. They just plundered Europe as far as the 9th, 10th century A.D. They just almost wiped Europe off the map. And it's thought that they may come from Tubal. The sixth name that's mentioned is Meshech. Meshech. M-E-S-H-E-C-H. Meshech, of course, is Russia. Now, I'm sorry that I don't have a world map in here. I always wanted one, but where we would put it and so on, I don't know. But Russia is an enormous piece of property. So when we put Russia in several of these places, like Magog and out of Tubal and out of Meshech, you want to remember that we're talking about ancient tribal settings. That is, some of these groups move up around the Caucasus, up north of the Black Sea. Some of them are over in the Armenian area. Some of them are by the Caspian area. And eventually, they are absorbed into this linguistic sort of Slavic tongue that sort of holds them together, this Russian language that sort of holds them together. These also settled in what we would call Armenia. Not Armenia. Armenians are theologians that have problems with eternal security and other things. Armenia is a place name. The last name that's mentioned is Tyras. T-I-R-A-S. Tyras is the progenitor of the Thracians. The Thracians. And the Illyrian Greeks. And then there's another possibility. There's a possibility of the Goths and the Scandinavians. The Goths, of course, settled in what land? What was their ancient land called? What name would you think it would be? Did you hear Gotland? Gutland. God's land. Gutland. Okay? I think it means Gutland. I'm not sure. Okay. Now, out of Javan, if you look at verse 4, four of the sons of Javan are mentioned. They really should be on the same level as this line of Gomer's sons, since they are actually first cousins. But I don't have room to put them on there, so I'm going to move them down here. Four of these are named. Four sons of Javan. Okay? They are these. Elisha. Not to be confused with the Elisha that succeeded Elijah. Elisha's name in Greek is Hellas. H-E-L-L-A-S. And hence, we'll put the word Greek, Greece after that. Hence, the name Hellespont. For that southern promontory of Greece sticks out into the Mediterranean Sea. In other words, the nations that lived there were said to have lived in the Hellespont. They get their name directly from Elisha. Okay? The second son of Javan, and who is also the fifth grandson of Japheth that's mentioned here, is Tarshish. T-A-R-S-H-I-S. I-S-H. Tarshish is Spain and North Africa. Okay? The third son is Kittim. Kittim. K-I-T-T-I-M. Kittim are the first Cyprians. So this would be Cyprus. And also Macedonia. In other words, when Alexander or Philip became the king of Macedonia, he is referred to in Greek literature as the king of Kittim. Okay? Okay. The next and the last name is the name Dodonim. Dodonim. D-O-D-A-N-I-M. Dodonim. Dodonim is the progenitor of the Rhodians and Dorian Greeks. This would be Rhodes and Dorian Greeks. Okay, now that's sort of an effort to get them all up in front of you where you can see the whole picture at one time. Again, number of these names are referred to by Josephus, by ancient historians, by ancient writers. And some of them it's hard to exactly pinpoint and locate. Moreover, they began to migrate. See, they began to intermarry and intermingle. They migrated mainly as tribes. They sort of kept separate as tribes for a long time. But then eventually, of course, they intermingled, they intermarried, and they lost some of their identity. But I think that we can identify these firmly enough that we know
the general movement, we can locate Japheth quite dogmatically, quite firmly as Indo-European. And he remains quite distinct. In other words, there isn't the intermarriage between the Japhethites that there is between the Hamites and the Sethites. And the Hamites and Sethites, we're going to have some languages, we're going to have some sons, grandsons that have the same names. We're going to have an intermingling of family languages. We're going to have some Sethites that have Canaanite dialects. See? Hamitic dialects. Japheth seems to remain distinct. And he is the one that is the progenitor of practically everybody in this room. Okay? Okay, now we're told in verse 6, 5, by these were the isles of the Gentiles. Now the word Gentiles is the word goyim. It is a word that means heathen. And it is to be understood in terms of the Jewish mentality. Goyim means a foreigner from a Jewish economy or from a Jewish state. Okay? By these were the islands of the goyim, the Gentiles, the foreigners, divided in their land. Everyone after or in accord with his tongue. Art Lowther asked if this word tongue last week was the same as the word language in 11:1. And I took a quick glance at the Hebrew text I had here, and I thought I saw the stem there, but I was wrong. It is not the same word. This is the word lashon. Lashon, that is translated tongue, always means one of two things. It either means the physical tongue, or it means a distinct language, a structural language. This, of course, means language. Everyone after or in accord with his language and in accord with their families or their ethnos in their nations. The word nation is the same word, goyim. In other words, goyim is a word that comes to mean a foreigner from a Jewish mentality, and it can be a name for the place where he lives. Okay. Now, last week we pointed out, here we have the ethnos, see? Here we have the ethnic division. Now, what about the language? The language, or the languages, I guess we'd have to say, of Japheth. Okay. Did I bring my language sheet? I didn't bring it with me, I guess. Meant to. Well, I didn't bring it. But essentially what you would have would be the languages of Europe. What we understand as Europe. They would be, of course, Greek. Well, let's start first with Sanskrit. Now, Sanskrit was not Europe because it was in northern India. But it is a Japhetic language. It is directly related to Greek. Okay? Latin would be part of this. German, French, Italian, Spanish, and so on. See? The Slavic languages, the Russian languages, all of those would be derivatives of the Japhetic strain. Now, I want to point out just a few things about the languages of Japheth that distinguishes them. Okay? Okay. The languages of Jacob characterized. And these characterizations will distinguish these languages from the languages, say, of Ham and the languages, say, of Shem. These three great structural linguistic divisions. Okay, what characterizes the Japhetic languages? First of all, they are all inflectional. They are all inflectional. Now, what does that mean? That means that the nouns and pronouns have case. That means that the verbs have conjugation. And when you put those two together, what does that mean to the average American? It doesn't mean anything. We don't study enough grammar to know. When we talk about a noun or a pronoun having case in English, we have what cases? What three cases? Nominative? Objective? No, that's the type of a sentence. Possessive case, yes. Now, how do we know in English the difference between the personal pronoun and the possessive pronoun? Say, personal pronoun, first person, is what? I. What is possessive of I? My. That's case. We can look at the word my and we can locate it and say that is a possessive first person personal, first person possessive pronoun. We can look at the word I, we can locate it, we can say I is first person nominative case. What is the objective case of the first person? Me. Okay? Then we have singular and plural. What is the plural of me? Us. Us. What is the third person personal pronoun? We're in number one category. Don't let me get you mixed up here. What's first person? Did I say third person? Third person personal pronoun. Not we. We is first person. He, she, or it. What is the plural of he, she, or it? They? Okay, or them. Objective case is them. Okay, that's nouns having case. Every one of these languages is characterized by a structure. And in that structure, all the nouns and the pronouns have case. All the verbs can be conjugated. For example, when we conjugate the verb I am, verb I am. Am is a verb, I, first person. I am, you are, you singular are, he, she, or it is. First person, second person, third person. Then the plurals. We, you plural, are, he, she, or they are. Okay, that's conjugating the verb, first person, second person. Same way, conjugate del verbo estoy in the indicative mood in español. Yo estoy, I am. Estoy is the verb, yo is the first person, first person. Usted is you, usted estás. Él, ella, está. Right. Nosotras. Estamos. Usted estáis, ella, ellas estáis. I am, you are, he, she, or it is. We are, you are, they are. Right? Take any language. German, I have. Ich habe, sie haben, sie es hat, sie haben. No, wir haben, sie haben, sie haben. Every one of these languages is characteristics of an inflectional language, where the Shemitic languages are agglutinative. You can recognize first person, second person, and third person. You can recognize the pronouns, but you recognize them more by the stems that are affixed to the prefixes or suffixes affixed to a stem. Totally different kind of a language altogether. Doesn't fit the same categorization. Okay. The second characterization of this language. How can I say this without? I'm trying to characterize this different than the. I have to say what it's not characterized by. Not characterized by the many gutturals of the Shemitic languages. In other words, when you study any of the Japhetic languages, the Indo-European languages, whether it's Sanskrit, Greek, or Latin, or German, you don't have all the intense guttural sounds and little minute distinctions like the k and the g and the k that you have in the Shemitic languages. You have, if you study a Shemitic language, whether it's Hebrew or Syrian or Iraqian or Arabic, you have to train your ear to hear those little distinctions in guttural kofs and kh and kh that are very important in the understanding and the enunciation of the language. Now, the European language have none of those little minute distinctions to them, you see. Okay? Okay. What else did we want to say? I guess that's enough on the characterizations. Let me show you an illustration of the relations, the relationship of the languages. This is one that I worked up years ago, and I think it really illustrates the relationship. In other words, I'm trying to show you the maybe the word interrelationship illustrated. Now, across the top line, we're going to have a movement from the west to the east. We're going to start way in the west with England. In ancient times, that's as far as you went, because anybody that was here in this continent was an Indian, a Mayan, which was unrelated to this. So we'll start with the west to the east. We're moving from west to east, and we're starting with England. All right, now in English, we have the word brother. And we're going to take that word, and we're going to work it all the way over to the East Indian Sanskrit. Okay? The word brother in England, English, is brother. The word brother in German is Bruder. The word brother in Latin is Frater. So that we have what at the colleges? Fraternities, brotherhoods. In Greek, it sounds exactly like the, well, it sounds very similar to the Latin, but it is frater, spelled with a PH. In Old Persian, it is brata. Now, I'm not trying to indicate here that Persian is a Indo-European language. Persian is Elam, and Elam is a Shemite. Okay? But the old Persian language, which is called Avestan language. Okay? The word the language Takhor, which is Central Asia, T-O-K-H-A-R, which was an Aryan language, is the word Prakar, P-R-A-C-A-R. And then in Sanskrit, and now you're as far as you can go toward India in the European languages, it is the word brahta, B-H-R-A-T-A, brahta. You can take the word mother and do the same thing. Here, mother in English, M-O-T-H-E-R. In German, Mutter, or Mutter. In Latin, Mater. So that we have the word in the hospital where the babies are born, maternity, see? In the Greek, it is mater. In the Old Persian, Eastern Persian, I'm sorry, Avestan Persian, it is matar. In Takhar, it is makar. And in Sanskrit, it is mata. Now that illustrates somewhat. You're reaching way back in time when you reach from English to Sanskrit, because English is sort of the scraps. Remember, in England there were the Picts and the Celts, and then the Angles came in, and the Saxons came in, then the Jutes came in, then the French came in. No. Then the Latins came in, the Roman army came in and conquered England. Then the Gauls came in. Remember? Normans, Gaullists. And England just mixed all those languages up, and that's why we have such a hard time today with English. Or one of the reasons we do. Okay? Okay, any questions about the languages or the Japhetic strain we could try to answer? Oh, this is my meat. I think this is just incredible. Essentially what happens to Japheth is, if Japheth and everybody was there at Babel, then when they moved out, they moved north and a little bit west, and then they broke. And some of them moved around the south end of the Caspian Sea. They became the Medes, possible progenitors of the Arians. The rest of them seemed then to move around the coastline of Asia Minor and across the Peloponnesus, through the islands, settled around what is now Greece, moved up into Europe. Some of them moved up in the Caucasus. So you get the idea of these people moving that way, see, away from Babylon, if that's where they were when they originally moved out. And that, apparently, is where God intended them to be. Okay? Any questions we could try to answer? All right, I think we have time for one more section. And this would be the Hamite section. I hope we have time. In verse 6, we have this statement. The sons of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, Put, and Canaan. There are four sons of Ham that are mentioned. The emphasis does not seem to be so much on the sons of Ham as it does on his one grandson, Nimrod. And Cush begat, I'm sorry, I skipped the verse 7. And the sons of Cush. Now there are six of these mentioned. Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Rama, Sabtecha, and the sons of Rama, Sheba and Dedan, or Dedan. Maybe we should get them on the overhead and try to get them located. Let's work on Ham a little bit. Okay. Ham primarily becomes Africa. Africans. And we have to say, we probably should have, first of all, up here instead of African, Egyptians. Africans. Canaanites. Now, what relationship Ham has to Orientals, we're not sure. But probably has some relationship there. Okay? Now, under Ham, we have four sons. And these are hard to get in because so many of their sons are named, or so many of the grandsons and great-grandsons of Ham are named. We'll start over here with Cush. Okay? By the way, one of the good verses for Ham, we'll put it up here, is Psalm 105 and verse 23. Will you look at Psalm 105? Keep this place marked in Genesis and look at Psalm 105 and verse 23. Psalm 105 is one of those rehearsals of Hebrew history. And when you get to verse 23, David says, Israel also came into Egypt, and Jacob sojourned in the land of Ham. Now what that tells us is that at least Egypt in the time of David was known as the land of Ham, where the Hamites eventually ended up. And it probably means that that is to be considered totally the land of Ham. In other words, all of Africa. Now, Cush is the progenitor of Ethiopia. And he was black. He was a black Hamite. There is a verse in the Old Testament that says, can an Ethiopian change his spot? Or can a leopard change his spots? Can an Ethiopian change his color? The word for Ethiopian is always a Cushite. He was a Cushite. Okay? Now, under Cush, we have six sons' names in verse 7. So we have to get them in our chart. And now we get cramped for space. But let's get them in here anyhow. The first one is Seba, S-E-B-A. Seba is the progenitor of the Sabians, S-A-B-E-A-N-S, who are none other than the Sudanese. The Sudanese, the land of the Sudan, or Sudea, which is south of Egypt. By the way, I haven't heard anybody say much about this, but I don't know if you've been keeping your eyes on Ethiopia. Let me try to get something on the map here, or get something on the overhead in terms of the map. Look here. Here's North Africa, and here is the Nile Delta. Then this sweeps around up to Israel, and this promontory represents Mount Carmel. And over here we have the Dead Sea, and the Sea of Galilee and the Jordan Valley. And down here we have two fingers pointing up with a promontory, and that's Sinai. This is the Red Sea. This is the Gulf of Aqaba. And, of course, right in here we have what canal? This is the Suez Canal. Now, to get to the Suez Canal, you have to sail up through the Red Sea. And to get into the Red Sea, this comes down, and this is the what peninsula? This is Saudi Arabia. And down here, we have the little, I don't know what you call them, kingdoms, principalities, the two of them, Kuwait and Yemen. Yemen. Now, as this comes down here, there's a promontory that comes out over here. And this promontory is called the what of Africa? The Horn of Africa. And over here we have the Indian Ocean. Now, the importance of this Horn of Africa is that it is strategically located because it controls the access to the Gulf of Suez. And if you can't get through the Gulf of Suez, then you have to sail all around Africa. Now, this horn is controlled by whom? Somalia. Now, over here, around Somalia, is Ethiopia. And Ethiopia, all during the time of Haile Selassie, who was a dictator, was very favorable to the West, but he was overthrown in a coup several years ago, and it has since become Marxist. Now, the leading Marxist state in Africa up until that time was Somalia. Somalia was one. I never forget the time I witnessed to a Somalian at CU, and I never had such a vindictive. Oh, the guy was full of hatred and animosity for the United States. He launched into a tirade. And my immediate response was, well, what? I used a little word. What are you doing here going to school if that's the way you feel about this country? Why don't you get out of here? What are you doing here being educated here? You just hate the place. Somalia was totally financed and controlled by Russia. But Somalia and Ethiopia got into a border conflict. And now, the last exact figures that I read by the CIA was that there are 18,000 Cuban fighting troops in Ethiopia, and there are Russian advisors. Somalia took some land, just moved in and took the land that really belonged, that they were arguing with Ethiopia about. Then Ethiopia, they just started a war over that land. So Somalia says, okay, we'll withdraw from that land. Ethiopia hasn't let off. Now, you see, if Ethiopia, or particularly Russia, can control this, then they can control the access through the Indian Ocean. And they can really control the oil that goes to Israel. And they control the oil that goes to Europe. I haven't heard anybody mention that. I think it's kind of interesting. Yemen is in no way favorable to the West. I forgot to put Sudan up there. Sudan is right to the west of Ethiopia. And Saba, or the Sabians, are the progenitors of the Sudanese. Now, Sudan, for a long time, was a great missionary field. The Sudan Interior Mission worked there. But several years ago, all the educational missionaries were kicked out of the Sudan. Oh, many years ago, in the 1965, something like that. And there aren't too many missionaries left in the Sudan. Now, the next four sons, Havilah, Sabtah, S-A-B-T-A-H, Ra'amah, and Sabtekha. All of these settle either in the Arabian Peninsula or in Africa. We have two sons of Rema that are mentioned at the end of the verse, Sheba and Dedan. Now, apparently they are mentioned because their names were famous. And later on, Abraham will have two sons to Keturah. And remember, Keturah he had taken out of the Canaanite tribes and married her. She was out of Canaanite tribes. And he names his two, or he doesn't name them, but two of his grandsons become named Sheba and Dedan. Sheba and Dedan were probably famous names. Okay, now all of these, Havilah, Sabtah, Rema, Sabtecha, Sheba, and Dedan, settle either Arabia and Africa. Now that meant, as you follow these people, if they were over in the Mesopotamia Valley, here are the Tigris-Euphrates rise up in Asia Minor, 50 miles apart, and yet they go for over 1,000. And God sends the confusion of the tongues, and the Japhethites go up this way, but the Hamites move this way. They move the exact opposite way of Japheth. And you don't go across over here unless you have an airplane. And they had a little trouble getting their airplanes off the ground in that day. So they went down along the coast, around southern Arabia, what we call the Arabian Peninsula, and then they just jumped across the Horn of Africa in their little boats that they had, and they settled into Ethiopia and Africa and down the Nubian Valley, the Nile Valley. They just move where the waterways are. And which you just read ancient Cambridge history, and I defy you if you won't find all of these names, or you'll find some of these names and the way and the course that historians figured they followed when they got over to Africa. You'll be able to trace them right back to the Babylonian area. Okay. There is one other name that becomes very significant simply because of who he was and how much space is allotted to him. The grandson of Ham and the son of Cush, and his name is Nimrod. And in all of this genealogy, there is no one who is paid so much attention to as is Nimrod. Verse 8. And Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a mighty one in the earth. Now that word translated mighty one, I don't have room on my overhead. I'll follow that whole thing up, is the word Sayyid. Now Sayyid can either mean a hero or a warrior or a tyrant. Somebody who stands out among men. And it can be everything from a hero to a dictator. Apparently, Nimrod was a despot, a tyrant. He began to be a mighty one in the earth. This word mighty is going to be repeated three times in two verses. And he was a gabur, that's mighty one, that's tyrant, that's despot. a despot literally of Hunt before the Lord, or in the presence of the Lord, or from the viewpoint of the Lord. He could see. Though he was a mighty hunter in the Lord, though he was a mighty one of the hunt, he did not escape the eye of the Lord. I think that's what it means. Even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter, whereas it is said, even as Nimrod, the Gibor of the hunt, in the face of the Lord, notice the word for Lord is Jehovah. Apparently, Nimrod was the first rebel against Jehovah that was able to organize a vast group of people. And he organizes, or he at least exercises his despotism all the way through the Mesopotamia Valley, all the way from Babylon, all the way to Nineveh. And so you have the description of that in verse 10 and 11. And the beginning of his kingdom was at Babel and Erech. Erech is the ancient Urech, and Akkad and Calmar in the land of Shinar. Alright? What is the land of Shinar? The land of Shinar is nothing more, nothing less than the Mesopotamia Valley. Here is the Black Sea, in case you didn't recognize it. Oh, I knew you all recognized it. Here's our little promontory. What's the name of that promontory? On Carmel, here's our Dead Sea with the two fingers sticking up. The Red Sea, I mean. Gulf of Aqaba. Dead Sea looks like somebody's kidney taken out, turned sideways. Sea of Galilee. And here is our great Arabian Peninsula, which juts down into the Indian Ocean, and over here reaches up in what is known as the Persian Gulf. Now, up here in the mountains of Armenia, there flows two rivers a long way and join down here, and this is Shinar. Okay. This is the Tigris-Euphrates River Valley. Now, all of these names are names of ancient places in the Shinar Valley southern part. Akkad, Urech, Ur of the Chaldees was there. Can't read any ancient history without reading these names. And the guy who... you'll notice that it doesn't say that he built Babel, but the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. In other words, that's where he started. Then he reached out to the city-state of Urech. Now, we'll have more about some of these when we get to Abraham. We're going to talk about Ur of the Chaldees at Linz, because it's been it's been excavated. So have a number of these others. He wasn't satisfied with this area. He decided to move north up the Mesopotamia Valley. And so the next verse, verse 11 says, and out of that land, not out of that land went forth Asher, he went forth to Asher. And Asher is Assyria. And he builded Nineveh, which is up here, you see, in the northern part of the Mesopotamia Valley, some 500 miles away. Okay? And the city of Rehoboth and Kala, and Rezin between Nineveh and Kala, the same is a great city. So Nimrod comes in for special attention because he is the first dictator and he is probably a black. So that was the beginning of white slavery. Nimrod is Shinar, or what we know best as Babylon or the Mesopotamia Valley. Okay, how are we doing for time? Not too bad. I think we can get the rest of these in a little bit of time that we have. Okay? Because Mizraim is real easy. Mizraim, M-I-Z-R-A-M, is simply Hebrew for Egypt. Now, Mizraim is a white Hamite. Cush is a black Hamite. Okay? Okay. Oh, that's right. I need more room for Mizraim. I forgot that Mizraim has all of his grandkids listed. Yeah, he has 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Takes a whole page. Well, anyhow, okay, I've got to sweep this out over here and bring it down here, and I have to take nearly the whole page. Okay, Mizraim. Now, Mizraim has... Here we run into one of those difficulties where we do not know whether the names that are given are the peoples or the sons. And most likely, it is the peoples and not the sons, because every one of them have a plural ending. They run like this, very quickly. L-U-D-I-M. Ludim, plural ending. The second one, Anamim. The third one, Lehabim. L-E-H-A-B-I-M. The fourth one, Naphtubim. N-A-P-H-T-U-B-I-M. Naphtabim. The fifth one, Pathrusim. P-A-T-H-R-U-S-I-N. Kasalim. The last two. See there, I'm all out of space already. Try to get it in like this. Kasluhim. C-A-S-L-U-H-I-M. And the last one, Kaphtorim. C-A-P-H-T-O-R-I-M. Now look, these are easy in terms of location. The first five of these, Ludim all the way to Pathrusim, they are Egypt and Africa. But the last two, Kasluhim and Kaphtorim, are the Philistines, who later go to Crete, then Philistia. They are the Philistines that you read about in the time of David. Okay? Okay. The singular case that we have as a son of Ham is the word put, or put. Put is Libya. Now, it's possible that there is another location for put, and that would be over in the Saudi Arabian Peninsula. But nevertheless, among the Hamites. And the last one is Canaan. Canaan. Now, Canaan's two sons are mentioned. Verse 15, and Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth. So out of Canaan now we have two sons, Sidon, of the famous Tyre and Sidon, and then Heth, H-E-T-H. Now, following that, you have the Canaanite tribes, and notice the change now in phraseology. You have the ite on all the endings. Verse 16, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Armkite, and the Sinite, and the Arvadite, and the Zemarite, and the Hamathite. And afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon up on the north, as thou comest to Gerar unto Gaza. And as thou goest unto Sodom and Gomorrah down by the Dead Sea, and Admah and Zeboim even unto Lycia. So he sort of outlines a square there in Palestine and says these were the settlements of the Canaanites. So, under these, we simply have the Canaanite tribes in their most primitive setting. The Jebusite, the Amorite, these all come under the Canaanites. The Girgashite. Sounds like a bunch of Protestant denominations. The Hivite. Presbyterianites. Methodites. Biblicites. Hivites, the Arkites. The Zemarite. And the Hamathite. By the time Israel becomes a nation, goes down to Egypt, moves out of Egypt, into Sinai, come into the land of Palestine, a number of these tribes have disappeared. Some other tribal names take their place. But these are the origin of those Canaanite tribes. Okay? Now, the last verse relative to Ham is found in verse 20. These are the families of the sons of Ham, after their families, after their tongues, in their countries or lands, and in their nations. And what are their languages like? Don't have time. I want to show you these languages next week. So next week we'll take up right there with the languages of Ham, the tongues of Ham. Okay? Isn't that exciting? Please say yes. You bet it is. Yes. Let's put it this way. Some will answer that question by saying that Ham was black, but there is no way that we know Ham was black. We know Cush was black. Or we surmise that Cush was black because the Cushites were always black in the Bible, or they're always referred to as a dark-skinned people. So we surmise that. Okay. The answer to your question in terms of a categorical statement is this. Within the sons of and the daughter, within the sons and their wives of Noah, were all the genes that were necessary to produce what we call today racial characteristics. All it took was the getting together of those genes in a fashion to produce racial characteristics. That apparently began with Cush. Now, I don't think that's as hard as the question as to the Orientals. And there is possibly a question of the intermingling of some of the Shemites with the Hamites that may have produced some of the Orientals, or some of the characteristics of the Indian peoples and so on, which are so distinct, so observable, so objective, they can be seen. But the categorical answer to what you ask is simply that once the genes got together, then the racial characteristics developed. How long that took, we don't know. We know with Cush, he's only a grandson, so it didn't take too long. Any other questions we could try to answer? No, no, no relevance to the land. Oh, I don't know. I really can't answer that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Don't know. I don't know how to answer. Many of the Shemites are very, very dark-skinned. Very dark. They don't have, however, some of the other characteristics. They don't have the kinky hair and so on, and the different facial bone structures and so on. So I don't know how to answer that question. It does appear, scripturally, that we could say that Africa really was the divine intent for the land of Ham. I think we could put enough words or name places together to say, hey, that was the direction that they were to go. Now, they apparently, these people obtrude into Shemite territory. And instead of adopting the God of the Hebrews, they are totally devoid of any sensitivity to God at all by the time the Hebrews get there, and they're to wipe these people out. Next week we'll take up with the languages of Ham. Boy, you better not miss it, because I'm telling you, it is the stuff. This is the stuff. And when we get to the language of the Shem, out of sight. Don't miss it. I don't recognize it. Might be. I don't recognize it. He's part of the Canaanite tribe in a very, very. You mean the person himself? I doubt that. No, he's too far removed generation-wise. But see, again, some of the names then become place names, and then people become named after the place names. He very likely could be in Heth's strain or in Heth's line. Okay? Okay, let's close in prayer. Thank you, our Father, for this opportunity to look at this passage that is so very, very significant to the settlement of this world, and makes more meaningful to us our identity, our relationship in terms of these families of nations. We ask that you'll increase our appreciation of nation states and above all of our own nation and of our own identity as a nation and our own identity with one another through this study, and that Christ may be glorified in all of it. For it's in his name we pray. Amen.